If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here at Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh. This is episode number 101. We've made it into the triple digits. I'm joined by the king of the Power Slam, Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, Kenny. I'm not bad at all. How's yourself? Hey, have you recovered from your trip?
Well, yeah, what a trip it was. The Vegas trip was great. It was really... It was a really like rewarding experience, and we got a lot of interview content. If you go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/InsideTheRopes, we got interviews with people like Bischoff and scrums with like Jericho and Cody, and from just the weekend alone, there have been over 550,000 hits of Double or Nothing content that we did. So it was, and then the Dustin show we did on the Sunday. Various people came up to us after the show and said that they thought we were the best panel show on the whole weekend. That's like 30 shows. It's a lot of competition. So even to be in the conversation is really good. Vegas is a really fun town, as I'm sure you can attest to, Finn.
I had
a great time, and there was like a WrestleMania weekend kind of vibe when you were there. Wrestling t-shirts all around the place. We were staying just off of the strip. So it was really good. I do want to tell you this though quickly, Finn. So if people listen to me on a podcast, right, you pretty much understand that I'm not the biggest New Japan fan in the world, right? I don't hate it, but yes. You know that, right? So yeah. I'm getting a Coca-Cola at the bar, and because I had the foresight to sneak in miniature vodka bottles, so I didn't need to pay the prices. $15, not a chance. So anyway, I got my five.
It was $15 for a vodka where?
In any of the arenas that you would go to, it was $15 for a vodka and Diet Coke.
Ah, that's ridiculous.
So smuggle in your vodka miniatures, get a Diet Coke for $5, you're sorted. So I'm standing in this queue, and this guy just goes, "Oh, Kenny, it's good to meet you." And I'm sort of high, chatting away. And he said, "Would you mind signing my belt?" I kind of looked at him just going, "Why would you want me? I mean, I'm going to probably devalue the belt if you put my name on it, but okay." So we go over, and if you have the belt, and like if you imagine the belt is the back of the plate is facing upwards.
Yeah.
So I can't see, I don't know what kind of belt it is. So I'm like looking across the signatures, and I've settled on beside Kevin Nash, because he's big, sexy, and I'm medium, sexy. And he'd said that he'd known me from What Culture. There was the whole fuck Kenny thing. So I just wrote something like, "Please do not fuck Kenny, Kenny kiss," or something like that. And he said, "Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you very much." And he turned it around. Do you know what belt he got me to sign?
Was it an IWGP title belt?
The IWGP United States Championship belt.
Wow.
I mean, could you find two people any less associated with that belt than me and Kevin Nash?
Not really, no.
So, baffled by that. But and then we also went to Batista's Italian restaurant, not run by Dave and the family, but, we saw it. It was like a really good Italian dive restaurant. I guess we should, to open the show, I did want to ask you this quickly, because we did get a tweet about this from Max Bush, and he says, "Hey Kenny, you've often said that Finn Martin is the king of the Power Slam, the magazine, not the move, which is true, but it's left me wondering who actually is the king of the Power Slam move. I would love to hear your responses." I think the Bulldog was always one of the best Power Slam guys, because it always felt like he did it with an impact, and I don't know whether that's just because that was my childhood one, so that's the one that I remember, but I would say he's probably my king of the Power Slam. Who do you think did the best Power Slam, Finn?
Oh, Davey Boy Smith for sure, British Bulldog, absolutely. I mean, I was always kind of partial to Steve Williams's power slam as well, the Oklahoma Stampede. I always thought that was a really impressive power slam. I think Buzz Sawyer used to do a pretty crazy power slam. But then again, pretty much everything Buzz Sawyer did was pretty crazy, wasn't it? So, but Davey Boy Smith for me, absolutely. And he kind of inspired the name of the magazine, I would say. I mean, power slam was still a very... I mean, does anyone really use any big-time wrestling? Does anyone really use the power slam as a finisher now?
Well, remember, for a while, they were trying to get it over as Braun Strowman's finisher. I don't know if it still is, but even then, it was like, when he would do that power slam, in my head, I would go, you need to watch some tapes of Davey Boy. He used to fling those guys over, and it would look great. But, Strowman's the only one in recent memory I can think of that did it,
I guess Braun does use it, but I know you don't really think of... I suppose it's because with Braun, he never really beats anyone.
Therein lies the problem with Braun.
Apart from Sami Zayn. So he doesn't really beat anyone with the move, that you don't really associate it with him. It doesn't really feel that big. Davey Boy Smith for me. And with Steve Dr. Death Williams bringing up the rear.
There you go. So, I mean, look, we're really going to be covering three topics this week. Double or Nothing, WWE's TV, and the John Moxley podcast interview with Chris Jericho. That's going to be kind of taking up the bulk of our show. So Sandra and I obviously covered us being there live for Double or Nothing, but you got a chance to watch it from home, which is obviously without the biasness of the live crowd and being in the arena. So did you watch the buy-in show, or did you just watch the pay-per-view?
No, of course I watched the buy-in, absolutely. I watched it on ITV4. I mean, it cut out abruptly at the end. There was some type of... I mean, they had Cody in the books and Kenny Omega. I think it was Brandy in the ring. And they were just doing the big hype job for final sell for the pay-per-view. And then it just cut off. And then it went straight on ITV4. It went straight into Death Wish 5, The Face of Death, which I've got to say was not one of Charles Bronson's best movies. So it just cut off abruptly. Was that the same in the States as well? I believe there was like 6 minutes. I read somewhere there was some dead air time or something between the pre-show and the pay-per-view. Did you hear that as well, Kenny?
I didn't think there was. I mean, I remember going to get a drink kind of at the end of the pre-show after the two matches. So I don't really know. I don't remember hearing anything about that. Maybe there was, and I just didn't see it. But we'll need to look into that and see what.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, prior to that, I mean, we had the Casino Battle Royal, which featured a good mix of like veterans and like newcomers.
Well, before we go into the two matches on the pre-show, let me just ask you, in terms of overall the presentation of the pre-show, how did AEW do? Do you think was this kind of similar to a WWE pre-show? Was it better? Was it worse? Like, where would you kind of rank it? And did it do a good enough job? You know, we talk about these Sunday Night Heats that we do on Patreon, about, you know, does the Sunday Night Heat before Backlash sell you on buying Backlash? How effective was AEW's buy-in show to get people to be tempted to buy Double or Nothing, would you say?
Well, I mean, it was definitely a flash, as you mentioned, Sunday Night Heat, a real flashback, because you've got them there talking about the pay-per-view and trying to find ways to encourage or persuade people to buy an event without doing the Bob Geldof, you know, give us your money, you know, without doing that. So, I mean, that's like an art in itself, isn't it? Trying to persuade people to actually spend money on your product without you coming across as sort of demanding or coming across a bit desperate. So I thought they did a good job there. I mean, there was some Alex Marvez said, this is airing live in the UK on ITV. This is one of the biggest shows to take place in the history of wrestling in the United Kingdom, which was like a completely ludicrous exaggeration. So I wrote that one down. I was just like, hold on a minute. Was it as big as SummerSlam 92? Was it as big as Battle Royal at the Albert Hall, or UK Rampage, or Big Daddy versus Giant Haystacks, or Big Daddy versus Mighty John Quinn, or even the Big Daddy tag match that took place every week on TV between 81 and 83? I don't think so. So, I mean, that came across as, and that really stuck with me as well, when we had the Elite out there for the big final push, and they were talking about the attendance figure in the MGM Grand Garden Arena, and then they exaggerated it to mock WWE right after one of the commentators had hit us with this huge exaggeration. He also mentioned as well that ITV viewers, trust me, you've got Kip Sabian coming up, your hometown hero. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Kenny, wasn't Kip Sabian like a heel when he was on World of Sport last year?
He was.
I think he was, wasn't he? So that one there was another gross exaggeration. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to mock WWE for exaggerating things, you also can't exaggerate things.
You have to be held to the same standards as everybody
else. Absolutely, you do. But, I mean, I thought the production was good. I mean, I enjoyed the Battle Royal. I thought the Battle Royal
the Casino Battle Royale this year, and that was the sequel to the
over budget
Battle Royal last
year. That's right. I mean, I thought the over budget Battle Royal All In was much better than this. But I still thought this was pretty good. I mean, it was, you know, Dreamer was there. He brought the rubbish bin full of objects in, and he was really over. Billy Gunn, Glacier, great to see him. He was still in pretty good shape. And a real mix of characters there. Sean Spears, formerly Ty Dillinger, he was really over. He looked like he had something to prove. So I was pleased to see him. I mean, Hangman Page won. I mean, that was kind of predictable, I think, that he was going to win it. But it was the popular choice in the venue. I think my only complaint, Kenny, would be it didn't seem like there was really anyone else there that could win it. Possibly MJF. I've got to say he did an outstanding job in the match of healing it up. Tremendous orator, tremendous promo guy. He looks a little bit like Colt Cabana, doesn't he? But I mean, he's like, you know, such a great heel. And I think he's going to do really well.
If Colt Cabana went to Burberry, then we have MJF.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether I really see him as a top guy, but I think he can be a vital mid-card player. And I thought he did really well here, playing off against Hangman Page. And he came out and made an appearance later in the show as well. So, I mean, I enjoyed the Battle Royal. I thought that was well done. How did it come across in the venue on the night, Kenny?
Well, I mean, there was some sort of production error that they had where the first five guys were out and the second five guys just kind of came out, but with no countdown clock, no music. Almost like something had just been a glitch. And then very shortly after that, the next set of guys came out. So I don't know whether they'd... So I think it was it supposed to be 3 minutes, then the next lot, and then another 3 minutes. It didn't seem like that was timed out as much as it would be normally, so I don't know what happened there, but...
Yeah.
When we were watching the Battle Royale, I've not watched it back on TV, but, I mean, we had a great time watching it. It really picked up in the second half. I don't know if there was a lot of stuff that maybe we saw live that wasn't picked up on camera, because that can sometimes happen when you're watching, like, five things happen at one time, but I thought it was a good Battle Royale, and Adam Page was the right chance. And I think you're right, the only other person in the match that I think had a chance was MJF.
Yeah.
And
those were the last two, weren't they? Eliminated MJF to win the match. So, yeah, there was some dodgy production for sure. Yeah, but I mean, you know, you've got a lot going on in those Battle Royals. And I thought they captured it pretty well, I've got to say. I thought they captured everything fairly well. I mean, it looked tremendous on TV, the lighting and everything, and looked absolutely A1. Looked so much better than the Ring of Honor New Japan Supercard from MSG, which I didn't really think. I don't think that really looked like a big-time presentation, even though it was in Madison Square Garden. This looked like a big-time presentation. Absolutely, it did.
And then they followed up with Kip Sabian and Sammy Guevara. Yeah. They had a match after that, which went about 10 minutes. Kip Sabian gets the win. I felt that this took too long to get going, and it was only really the last couple of minutes that were really good. How did this one come across on TV? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem was no one really knew who Kip Sabian was. I mean, he's done very little. I mean, he's mostly worked in the UK. So, I mean, he came out and he did try and really work the crowd and get them involved. But he was clearly somebody that most of the audience weren't aware of who he was. I thought the other guy, Sammy, how do you pronounce his surname again, Kenny?
Guevara.
I thought he was tremendous. I mean, what a heel. What an athlete. What a performer. And I thought it was a real gutsy decision by AEW to put the guy over who no one really knew. And that was all about making stars. It's like, we want to make this guy into a star. We believe in him. People don't really know who he is. This is his big break. Let's give him a chance. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world to have Kip Sabian go under, but he went over here, and that was the right decision to me to try and make a new star. But I thought Sammy was just a tremendous performer. Just watch him do the kip up, and it's just so effortless. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anyone do it that. I mean, Shawn Michaels was always the king of that move to me, but he did it even better than Shawn Michaels. And I never thought I'd say that, Kenny.
There you go. Hell's frozen over. You're right.
The match was a little too long. Kind of suffered from a muted response for a lot of the match, and probably would have benefited from being 3 or 4 minutes shorter. But I mean, I thought it was a good match. I did enjoy the match. I thought it was well done. I thought they both looked really good out there.
So let's go into the pay-per-view portion. We had the awful rendition of the American National Anthem by that family, who were not in sync at all.
I'm going to say I skipped that, Kenny.
You did yourself a favour. I wanted to ask you, because the only match I've watched back fully... No, I've watched back the top three matches, the Cody and Dustin, Young Bucks and Lucha Brothers, and Omega and Jericho. Talk to me about the commentators. We've got JR, Alex Marvez and Excalibur. How did each of them do? What was the dynamic like? And how does it compare to other wrestling commentary teams that we've got out there at the moment?
I felt like Excalibur and Alex Marvez were very well informed. They really knew their stuff. I mean, they knew the history, and they were there trying to get these acts over that people may not know. So from that standpoint, I thought it was really good. I think maybe they'd be better going with a two-man team, because they were kind of stumbling over each other at times. Jim Ross, I'm not really sure what he has to offer anymore. Kind of felt like to me that he was a little bit out of touch with the product. And I think Excalibur and Alex Marvez would have worked better together without him. That may not be a popular viewpoint, but I don't really feel like... I think I would rather if there was just him and one other, or just Alex and Excalibur. It seemed to me like there was too many people on commentary. And I know it's in vogue now to have three-man commentary teams. But I remember when they were first invented, well, not first invented, them should have been around many years, but when they became sort of popular, everyone was saying, why have we got three people at the desk? We only need two. And it really felt like there was too many people on commentary.
Most of the feedback that I saw online on sort of Saturday and Sunday, and just from speaking to people who had watched it, was that JR and Excalibur almost seemed like the two announcers, and Marvez was kind of the third wheel. I did think that in the top three matches, that's all I've heard, I felt like Jim Ross sounded like the old Jim Ross. He was passionate, he was involved. I think I also watched the SCU and Strong Hearts match as well, but I mean, I don't know, maybe it is this thing with, because Excalibur has got a lot of, he's very well liked as a commentator from what I've heard, in sort of indie wrestling. So, I mean, JR and Excalibur, that could be a kind of a cool team. I mean, it's smart to have Jim Ross there because he is so recognisable. And if he can still do the job, you know, to a certain level, then you know, it makes sense for them to have him out there. But, yeah, I guess we'll see where the three-man booths don't tend to work ever, really, do they? Like, has there been a great three-person booth?
I mean, I think the NXT crew, apparently, I think it's Percy Watson. I think he's left now.
Percy's left WWE.
Yeah. I mean, I thought Percy Watson and Ronaldo and Nigel Guinness, I thought that was the best three-man team I've heard. But I mean, you know, you've got to cut them some slack. You know, it was their first show together. So, I mean, I kind of feel like maybe it's a bit harsh to say that they didn't do that well together. I don't really think they did. And if you've just got two people there, that's more time for both people to say what they want to say, and for them to really get that chemistry and that rhythm together. And if you've got three people, it's more difficult to achieve that. With the NXT 3, which obviously is no more. They've worked together for a very long time, so they know what they're doing. They've had a chance to fine tune the chemistry and the formula, and to chime in when, to really know when someone has finished speaking and chime in with what you're going to say, and then it's all nice and smooth as it should be. So, you know, I kind of feel maybe that's a little bit harsh for me to really knock the commentary, because it's all, this is obviously an entirely new promotion. They're trying to find the feet here. But it just seemed to me like I felt the commentary could have been better. And I think they need to go with a two-person team in future. That's what I would suggest.
Overall, talk to me about the production values on the show, the presentation of it on TV. Where does it rank in terms of other wrestling companies that have done pay-per-views before? And did they get it good enough on the first night, do you think?
Well, I mean, there were some things that they did miss. But I mean, I think overall the lighting was tremendous. I thought the set looked really good with the giant chips. I mean, I think on the pre-show you mentioned something about there's some confusion there. And certainly when they were explaining the rules of the Casino Battle Royal, they had them on screen and didn't even really try and explain them. And one of the, I can't remember who it was, I think one of them said, oh, the rules are quite convoluted, but don't worry, it'll make sense as we go along. And I didn't really get, I mean, I guess I could have worked out the rules if I wanted to, but I just thought, if I've got to try to work these rules out, then that's too much effort for me, I'm afraid. I'm just, you know, it should make sense to me. Why are you overcomplicating this? So, I mean, I thought, you know, the production did look really good with the graphics on screen and with the big giant screens at the top of the stage. And yeah, I mean, you can always nitpick, can't you? I mean, you can nitpick with WWE, and they've been doing it for decades. But I thought overall it was pretty good. I mean, I thought it was really good, actually. There was nothing about it that really offended me. There was nothing about it that where you're going, oh, they blew it there, or they missed that, or how did they get that wrong? Most of it just flowed very nicely. So there's nothing really jarring about it, I didn't feel. Can I just quickly go back to that commentary?
Yes.
Some of the times, like, for instance, JR at one point, he's got drawn in on about tag team wrestling, as though it's like, you know, he's saying, well, why can't tag team wrestling be good? Well, tag team wrestling is good. We've got really good tag team wrestling in Impact Wrestling. We had great tag team wrestling in NXT. I mean, occasionally tag team wrestling in WWE is pretty good. We had, like, that Fatal 4-Way match at WrestleMania was really good. I mean, they were on the commentary, they were just saying things that were just kind of as if they were having a go at WWE for the sake of it. And it's just like, well, why are you having a go at WWE about tag team wrestling? And it's just that, well, okay, it's not since post-WrestleMania, tag team wrestling's fallen off a cliff, I'll grant you. But I mean, we've still got a lot of good tag team wrestling out there, and they're talking about it like it's something that we haven't seen or it hasn't been good in years. Just comments like that, it just kind of irked me a bit, really. It's just, you don't need to say that. Put over your guys. Don't rubbish the competition to make yourself look good. And that was something that was sort of, that was something that came through quite a lot in commentary and with various things that happened on the show, as I'm sure we'll discuss in a moment.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting observation. I'm looking forward to watching it back and see if those things kind of, you know, play out to me now that you've said it, so we'll see. So let's go through the matches on the main show and let me know what you think, Finn. So we got SoCal Uncensored, obviously, Daniels, Kazarian, Scorpio Sky against Strong Hearts from OWE, and they had this barn burner of a 6-man opening tag, goes about 13-14 minutes. What did you make of the opener?
Yeah, really enjoyed it. I thought, you know, Daniels, Kazarian, Scorpio Sky were the worthy winners. Thought people really got into it. And just a all-action 6-man, which is, you know, you always want a really lively match to kick off the show. And after the fans were kind of lukewarm to most of the Guevara versus Kip Sabian match, I thought this was something that really turned up the dial, really turned up the heat. Yeah. Big energy, you know, lots of action and very popular outcome as well. So, yeah, I enjoyed the opener. What did you think to it, Kenny?
I loved it. I thought it was, it's funny. The fact that it was only 13 minutes, it felt to me like it was a lot longer, but like in a good way. So I thought the match was great. I loved. I don't know each of them by name, so I don't want to. But one of the strong hearts, the smaller guy with the blonde hair and no knee pads, he was insane. He was lifting up Daniels for a German suplex like it was easy. So you know, I thought they were. It's an example of the thing that WWE, you know, they don't seem to be able to book foreign performers and just let them be good. And here we've got the strong hearts who I've never seen before in my life. And by the end of it, I wanted to see more of them. And I don't think it's a hugely foreign concept. So I'm glad to see that AEW are showing that. It wouldn't be the only time in this show where they would bring in foreign talent who would play to their own strengths and the fans got with it and it got over because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this was very much like a TNA or an Impact Wrestling show opener where they'll often put the X Division guys on first for a real, you know, spectacular opening
high
match.
Energy.
Yeah, high energy match. So, which is something that's always worked well for Impact Wrestling and TNA before it. So, it was Shima, T-Hawk, and was it L. Lindemann, I think, were the,
yes, that's correct.
The other side. Yeah.
Then we had, it was supposed to be a triple threat with Dr. Britt Baker and Nyla Rose and Kylie Rae. And then Brandy comes out to say that she, you know, she had been, because she'd in the Road to Double or Nothing called all of them separately and said that they were her favourite to win. But she said she doesn't need a great match, she needs an awesome match. And this brought out the return of Awesome Kong. When we were in the building and Awesome Kong came out, it was one of the biggest reactions ever. Because I don't think anybody really expected it, but when it happened, it felt like it was like, well, yeah, that is something you could do. And for me, before I ask you what you think about it, what I thought was really clever was they played up the idea that like when Brandy came out, that she was going to do the Stephanie thing and kind of just like make it about her. And then the tease is that it's, you know, she comes in ring gear as if she's going to wrestle.
Yeah.
But really, she's introducing you to the newest member of the roster, Awesome Kong. So, I thought that was a clever little nuanced part of it. But what did you make of the Fatal 4-Way, the return or debut of Awesome Kong? Talk me through your thoughts.
Yeah, really enjoyed this. I thought this was very well done. A very serious match. I mean, Awesome Kong, as you said, was a very popular addition to this match. I mean, do you remember, you know, back in October, there was a big rumour, wasn't there, that the cast of Glow were going to make an appearance at Evolution. Do you remember that?
And then they ended up doing something like on a SmackDown before it or something, where a couple of the women turned up, and we were thinking if they did it, would Kong be there?
Yeah, and it didn't, and I thought maybe it was cancelled because of the whole Saudi Arabia hoo-ha, you know, with the whole thing there. I thought, well, perhaps they don't want to be associated with WWE because of that, which would have been understandable. And when Awesome Kong turned up here, the thought occurred to me, oh, maybe they'll be able to get Glow involved on some level, because that's obviously one of the biggest shows on Netflix. And, you know, because season 3 will be out, I would think fairly soon, I would have thought.
Yeah, it usually comes out about May or June, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, that would be a tremendous tie-in for AEW if they can get the Glow actresses and actors involved. So I just thought, wow, you know, maybe we've got a connection there. So obviously, Kaya Stevens, Awesome Kong, is part of the Glow cast for those who haven't seen Glow. So I really enjoyed this match. I mean, it was a really good effort. Britt Baker won. She's the dentist. And I just thought the finish of the match was really professional. You know, you were just kind of thinking, you know, is this going to fall apart at any point? Because, you know, you're having flashbacks to Lacey Evans, you know, and some of the other female performers in WWE. And it didn't. And it was just the finish was really strong. And I guess it would have been, again, a really easy thing to put Awesome Kong over because she's the established name and she's huge and it would have got cheap pop. And instead, this was all about putting someone new over and making a star out of Britt Baker. So, I thought this probably was my favourite match on the undercard of the four. Would you say there'll be four undercard matches before?
Yeah.
Dee and Dustin Rhodes locked up. So this was my favourite match on the undercard, simply because it exceeded my expectations and they put somebody over and tried to make a star, which is something we desperately need WWE to do, Kenny.
We do. Well, and the clever thing about the match as well is that, like, Nyla Rose and Kylie Rae and Awesome Kong already kind of have their gimmicks set. Like, you know, Nyla Rose is the beast who is going to try and terrorize through people. Kylie Rae is the smiley, huggy, relatable person that we all know. And yeah. Awesome Kong's a monster. Whereas Britt Baker, even though she's got the dentist gimmick, like, she's kind of almost maybe the blandest of the group.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to give her the win because, you know, she needs it more.
She needs the attention. She needs that spotlight. You know, that's why you put that person over, because she needs it more than the others. And fans were really enthused for this match. I mean, it just, you know, peaked at the finish. And just, I think pretty much everything here was spot on. I was really impressed.
Then we had a tag team match with the Best Friends, Chuck Taylor and Trent Barretta, against Angelico and Jack Evans. This match went, I think it was about 12 minutes or something. Best Friends ended up getting the win. I thought it was some pretty decent tag action again, and it left me feeling positive about AEW's tag division going forward. What did you think of the match?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I didn't enjoy it as much as the previous two matches. Maybe felt a little bit similar to the opening match. I mean, I know we had the big angle afterwards. You know, and another thing that the announcers did that kind of annoyed me, Kenny, was that each time people came, they were saying when Chuck Taylor and Trent Barretta were out, the announcers were saying, well, they're making their AEW debut. It's like, well, of course they are. It's the first AEW show. You know, just stuff like that was just throughout the card. They were saying things like that. It's like, well, you don't need to say that. We know it's the debut. It's AEW's debut. So, I mean,
hopefully the good thing with when they go on TV, that they're not going to have like a Vince screaming at you in your headset. So hopefully they can learn to grow as they go.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
It's just like, you know, you're just stating the obvious. You don't need to tell me that. And maybe I'm nitpicking. I probably am, Kenny, but I'm pretty good at that. You know?
Classic so, friendly.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was probably the match that I enjoyed, my least favourite match on the undercard. Kind of felt a bit similar to the opener. But, I mean, all four of these guys are really talented. And the fans were into it. So, I mean, it was a success on the night. Taylor and Barretta won. And then we had the angle afterwards with the Super Smash Brothers.
Yes. How did you feel that came across on TV? Because live we were just like, what is going on?
Like, I didn't think it came across that well. I mean, they arrived under cover of darkness. It's like, is it going to be Kane? No, it's not going to be Kane. Of course it's not going to be Kane. And then they all turned up with all the guys in masks, and I didn't think that went over that well. And then the announcers were saying, what's going on? Who are these guys? And they were sort of playing dumb as to who they were. And it's like, well, why don't you tell us who they are? And I thought that was a bit of a blunder. For all the people who didn't know who they were, why don't you tell us? Because you obviously know. So, I wasn't really that impressed with the commentary there. Didn't really think that much of the post-match angle, but I guess they thought that they needed something. This match needed something else, and you know what? Maybe it did do.
The thing that I didn't understand was, you see the bald guy who's in Super Smash Brothers,
yeah,
and he has like one or two little bits of black camouflage in his face. It looked like he'd got like 10% of it done and then ran out of time, rather than it being like. Like, to me, it just, when I saw him, I was like, oh, you look unfinished. You know, it's like when Edward Scissorhands got made and he hadn't had time to make the arms yet, so he's got scissors for hands. That's what these guys, it looked like that crater guy in World of Sport. It just looked all really right. Naff, like really like amateur compared to, but look, you know, look, again, as much as maybe it didn't, I don't think it worked in execution, I think that they are probably already well aware of that, but it was an attempt to get new people in the spot. So even if it didn't work, there was an intention to it, which I think we can probably understand.
Yeah, and it sets something up for the next show. So there's that as well. I mean, I think there should have been an interview with them backstage. I think that would have been helpful.
Yeah. That, yeah, and
so, you know, since we don't have a TV program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday or Thursday or Friday to explain, oh, who are these guys? Oh, the first interview with them. So it's like, why not do an interview with them backstage so they can explain why they're here? Explain who they are and what their motivation was for attacking Taylor and Beretta, you know, and I thought that was, again, a glaring omission, Kenny.
Up next, we had the six women tag team match. I was very excited about this. I never thought I'd get to see Aja Kong live. She is an absolute babe. So we get Aja Kong along. I'm about to murder Japanese names here, so bear with me. Aja Kong teamed up with Yuka Sakazaki and Emi Sakura. And
that's right.
They took on Ryo Mitsunami, Ryo Abe, and Karu Shida.
Shida, that's right, yeah.
There we go. I thought this was excellent. I loved, because I didn't know any of these women, right, apart from Aja Kong. So I'm going to just no preconceived notion of who they are. One of them is dressed as Freddie Mercury. The other one looks like she's just cosplayed as Kairi Sane. They can all work. They all wrestle very well. You know, there's not a duffer in there. Do you know I mean? It's not like when you go, oh God, when this person gets in, it's going to be rubbish. They all played, you know, when the Freddie Mercury lady was doing the toe taps to the beat of We Will Rock You. Like, it was so much fun. And I thought this match was just really, really good slice of fun. And I know you've watched a lot of Japanese women's wrestling. Do you think that this was a good showcase of some of the women that are in Japanese wrestling right now and what they can do, or was it?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I was concerned at first about Aja Kong. I mean, I've got to say, I haven't seen that many of her matches recently, but I know she's slowed right down because she's been doing this for a very long time and she's obviously got a lot of knee problems. So at first you're thinking, you know, is everyone just going to have to run around her and bump into her? And she did, as the match picked up, she started doing more.
She put in a shift.
She certainly did. So she certainly did everything that she was required to do. She got out of there and let the other five do the really athletic stuff. I mean, I thought this was a really good match. I mean, it was like, obviously there was a slight blunder at the end where there was a cover. The referee counted, I think the referee didn't count three, but then the bell rang and then the match continued, and that was just before the finish. So that did really sort of deaden the finish a little bit, which was a shame for them.
I do think we should give some props to the referee, because the referee did a great job of bringing that back.
Yeah.
Because as soon as the bell rang, the referee was just kind of like, no, it was two. I didn't say three, and just shut it down straight away. And to do that on the pressure of a first night, and I'm guessing in a bigger crowd than they've been used to being in front of, I thought the referee deserves a lot of praise for trying to save that as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, we still have the JT Smith chant. I mean, can you believe that that's still going after all these years? You know, the UF Duck chant. I mean, that was started in the ECW arena after JT Smith fell off the top rope and landed on his head. So, I mean, we've got ECW to thank for that one. That's their contribution to pro wrestling. One of their many, of course. They brought it back. It was just a shame that that happened, because that could have been a really heated near fall. And instead, it was one of those moments where you're like, oh, was that the finish? And, the match is still going. And they kept going and did the planned finish. So, I mean, I thought this was very well done. Completely different match to the other undercard matches, which is, I think, very important. That's always really nice to see as well. I mean, it seemed to get over really well in the building, Kenny. Was it really?
People loved it, yeah. I think it was just, it was easy to see what you were watching.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the key, is like, if you live in America and a Japanese women's wrestling match is at its best when you just let them wrestle and let them do their kind of character stuff within the match, then just let them do that. You know, and that seems to be what worked here. So, and plus, I know that from a technical perspective, it'd be absolutely awful. But if we could get Awesome Kong versus Aja Kong, oh, that'd be like my dream match. Hogan Andre too.
I think you will find it online. I think that match has happened.
Oh, has it? Oh, has it happened already? Okay.
I'm sure it has done.
So. Yeah, kill my buzz. Okay, so up next we had Cody taking on Dustin Rhodes. Lots to unpack here, from Cody putting a sledgehammer through a throne, Brandy Rhodes speeding Dustin getting juice, Dusty chance, Dusty's favourite chance, a 22-minute match. The crowd just lapped it up. talk me through how this match came across when you were watching it on TV.
Yeah, I mean, it really felt like, I think it felt like the biggest match of the night. I guess we should mention before Ann Kenny that we had a throne set up on the stage. And then Cody went to the ring, took a sledgehammer, walked back up to the stage, and then struck the throne with a sledgehammer, and this pyro effect went off and everyone cheered. So that was another little dig at WWE there, not very subtle. So we had that. But I mean, it seemed to go down well with the frustrated WWE fans in the building. So even though it's supposedly Triple H is the one who's going to save the day. So, but yeah, anyway, getting back to the match, Earl Hebner was the referee. It obviously was built up with a really good story. You know, the brothers, this was all about Cody killing off the Attitude Era. And it was like current generation versus older generation. That was really stressed on commentary. Brandy was, she was interfering. She was thrown out and Dallas Page came out and carried her to the back. We had a lot of blood in the match. We had a lot of blood. Now, do you think, Kenny, this match would have been as good without the blood?
No, I think it needed the blood. I actually thought this was Jim Ross's. I thought Jim Ross was better commentating this match than anything I've seen him do in about a decade. Because it felt like there was a story to tell, right? And that's when Jim Ross has been at his best as a commentator, is when there's a story. And he is familiar with the story. He knows the people in the story. He worked with Dusty Rhodes. So I thought that his commentary really added to the match for me when I was watching it back. I thought this was easily the match of the night. And Dustin said something on the Inside the Ropes show that we did at Starcast the day after, where he was talking about how, you know, he felt in the room that everybody was with them, and that, you know, they could essentially do no wrong in some ways at that point, because people were just really with them. And I was talking to somebody who was in wrestling. I can't remember who it was, but they're talking about the match, and he said, you know, it was Meltzer. Meltzer had mentioned something about, you know, not often that you see wrestling matches where the guys in the ring are crying and people in the crowd are crying. And then somebody else over the weekend had said, you know, that's like a once in a decade kind of thing. You don't get that all the time. And I didn't feel the story even seemed forced. It all seemed very genuine, and they managed to create this story out of 2 4-minute YouTube videos. And that's all it took. So what I'll say is I put out a tweet during this when I said, WWE did not deem this match to be worthy of a WrestleMania. That, which is true, you know. I know. I think this was the best way for it to happen in the end, but still, it just makes WWE look mighty silly to have not just, you know, let them have a match back in the day. But what did you make of the match overall?
Well, I mean, I do know what you mean there, Kenny, because I mean, if WWE had promoted it, I think we should mention that if WWE had promoted it, it wouldn't have been given anywhere near as much time as this had on pay-per-view. And wouldn't have been received or treated in the way that this audience did. So,
and they would have probably wanted to make the entire match about Dusty Rhodes.
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, I think they probably would have liked to have done the match while Dusty was still around, and he could have been a part of it. But I mean, it wouldn't have felt as big, I don't think. And in a sense, it would have been big because Dusty would have been involved. So I'm sure they would have liked to have done it in WWE, but had they done so, it wouldn't have been as big here. You know, it just wouldn't have been. So, I mean, I enjoyed the match. I thought it was well done. It was very deliberately paced. We had all the, you know, we had that old school sort of blood loss with the big time selling and those long pauses between big moves, like what you get on big New Japan shows, and you're getting some WrestleMania matches as well, where they've got the time to really sell things and to really sell the gravity of what's happening. It was the right decision for Cody to go over. And then afterwards, he said, you know, I've got a tag team coming match coming up with the Young Bucks. You know, I don't need a friend. I don't need a partner. I need a brother. And they hugged and they agreed to team up. And I mean, that was a nice segue into what they're doing next. So, yeah, I thought it was all well done. It was just a one match feud, one match series. We didn't need a rematch. I think most people would agree with that.
Dustin did actually say on stage the next day, and I think he meant it. And I can see there's some chats that he had behind the scenes and chats there on stage. He said that he will not wrestle his brother ever again.
Okay.
And which, you know, look, that's when you do that. I mean, I think that match was about as much of perfection as you could get in terms of like story and like the way they told it, the way the crowd was, and like there's no reason to try and revisit that because you're only going to have diminishing returns.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there is no point. Absolutely no point at all because it's not going to be as good. So why revisit it? Absolutely, it's no point at all.
Okay, so I think it was after this where we got the world title presentation where we had Bret Hart, Jack Whitehall, Hangman Page, MJF, Jungle Boy and Jimmy Havoc all involved. Bret Hart was a big surprise. Do you think is this in any way some sort of statement of like, you know, legends are not just for WWE to use or whatever? Because Bret got a huge reception in the build. Nobody expected him to be coming out. I do want to say it annoyed me tremendously that Jack Whitehall introduced him as Bret Hart and not Bret the Hitman Hart.
Why did that annoy you?
Because when you go, the best there is, the best there ever will be, Bret the Hitman, and you do the full thing, you don't go Bret Hart. Nobody's ever said Bret Hart, so it sounds so jarring. Fucking Jack Whitehall. What did you make of the world title presentation?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed seeing Bret Hart out there and getting a good response. And I mean, I think it was quite a coup to get Jack Whitehall. I mean, didn't he introduce? Was it the Brit Awards this year? I think he did, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he did.
So I mean, he's a big deal. I mean, I'm not really a fan of his either, but I mean, he is a big deal. I mean, no one can deny that. And he seemed like he wanted to be there. I mean, we can both name lots of celebrities who've appeared on WWE shows who kind of feel like you can tell from the body language and the demeanor and everything that they think it's beneath them. He didn't. He seemed genuinely thrilled to be there. So that's something that always makes my heart sing, Kenny, when I see that. From a celebrity. And Bret was there and he like seemed like he wanted
and
to
Bret
be
was there. Bret turned up.
But with Bret, right, I mean, he's a guy that sometimes when he's in WWE, I often wonder why he's even there. Because he sort of looks like he doesn't really want to be there. And there's obviously reasons for this with his history in the company and the fact that he has grudges against certain people who work there. And there's been many instances when he's been there and you think, well, why are you there, Bret? But on this occasion, he really looked like he wanted to be there. He appreciated the response that he got. And it felt like he had a purpose there. And he got the belt out. I mean, it looked like he spent some money on that belt. I can't say I really liked it that much, but it looked big time. Then they introduced Adam Page. He came out selling the knee injury. They mentioned on commentary that, again, that this was as a result of the match with Pac in, I think, was it Nottingham in the UK anyway?
The WrestleGate.
That's right. And then MJF came out and he just stole his segment. This was his segment. He just blew them all away. And I bet Jack Whitehall's watching and he's listening and he's thinking, this kid's good, isn't he? He's really good. And I thought MJF just absolutely, he just stole his segment. He was the man here. I mean, as I say, I don't know whether he can be a top guy, but he can be a big star in this company as a mid-card player, and he can make whatever, if they come up with their version of the US title or the Intercontinental title or whatever they have as a secondary belt, which I'm sure they'll have, he's somebody who can hold that and he can make that belt mean something. So I thought it was great there, coming out, healing it up. And as you said, then we had Jungle Boy out, who is the son of
Luke Perry.
He was out. Jimmy Havoc came out. And then they beat down MJF, and that was the segment. But yeah, this was MJF. This was the MJF show, and I thought he did fabulous.
Yeah, I loved the line about like, "Oh, Brett, a fan's attacking you." It was because that's what heels should do—is kind of play on those kind of things. I liked that when Brett, you know, said, "Oh, Paige and Jericho wrestle at the next pay per view, or next month, or maybe in a couple of months," and then he just went, "I've not done this in a while. I'm rusty." And he even had a joke, you know, Bret Hart cracked a joke.
Yeah, I caught that one as well. A nice little acknowledgement there. I mean, let's face it, Kenny, you and I have screwed up enough damn times over the years. Always nice, you know, it's always a nice to have that self-awareness that this has just happened and acknowledge it. And you get people on side when you do that.
The thing with when you work with Bret Hart, the problem is, look, Bret's completely healthy. Bret's, you know, fully compensated and all that kind of stuff. But because of the ramifications of his stroke that he had, you know, maybe there's like a couple of seconds delay on some stuff, right? Which is understandable from someone who's had a serious stroke and all, whatever. All I can say is from working with Brett before, he is he's the loveliest guy on planet Earth. But when you book Brett, you don't, like, nothing's guaranteed till he agrees to it on the day. So I feel, you know, they were smart to not give him a lot of stuff to do. But the kind of thing that, like, you know, it really should have been handled better. But when Brett just, like, didn't know what side to put the belt up at, and he's just, like, you know, putting it around to all sides but the hard cam. And in the arena, there was this little kind of crew guy who I swear was, like, blowing a gasket of, like, redness out of his throat as he's trying his best to get Brett to move the belt around, and then Brett would like move it around for a second and then go to the next bit, and this poor guy is having a heart attack on the ground because he's trying to get this belt on the hard cam for 5 seconds. So that made me laugh. We get the Young Bucks against the Lucha Brothers for the AAA World Tag Team titles. Young Bucks retained. This was like a 25-minute match. What'd you make of the semi-main?
Yeah, it's, Pentagon Jr., Rey Fénix, they were a great team. We're really fans, real big fan of those two guys. Not such huge fan of Young Bucks. Not really my thing, really, the Young Bucks, Kenny, if I'm honest. So, I've seen better from, I would much rather watch Pentagon Jr. and Rey Fénix wrestle LAX, if I'm honest. So, I thought the match lasted too long. It was a big hit in the venue. You know, this is the act, or one of the acts, that this crowd came to see. I'm not really a fan of the Young Bucks, so this match really wasn't for me, if I'm honest with you. I don't mind them for about 15 minutes, but I just thought the match lasted too long.
Yeah, this kind of match is not dedicated. It's not designed for me. You know, I thought the match was good, really good. They did a lot. I mean, look, the fact the Young Bucks were able to have that kind of match, having not wrestled regularly for 4 months, is a really impressive feat, you know, physically. And I think that the people who came to see the Young Bucks versus the Lucha Brothers got exactly what they wanted. And they all left happy. So somebody like me or you, who might not be as into their kind of matches, you know, I was still able to enjoy parts of it. But, you know, it just wasn't like Cody Dustin was always more of a match for me than the Young Bucks and the Lucha Brothers. But that's the thing about this. You know, we said this before. They kind of almost need to be a variety show to try and appeal to everybody. And that's,
absolutely. I mean, the thing about it was the show had already hit its emotional peak, hadn't it? I mean, Cody versus Dustin was like Daniel Bryan versus Kofi Kingston at WrestleMania. So, I mean, and this did a hell of a lot better than the matches did after Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston at WrestleMania. So this maintained the interest. And they were out there for a long time and fans were really into it. So, I mean, this is perfect for the audience that they're catering their promotion to. You know, I don't really need to see the Young Bucks do their thing for the amount of time that I just mentioned. 15 minutes or so is plenty for me. And, you know, on commentary, the same. Why can't tag team wrestling be great? It's like, well, tag team wrestling is great in many other promotions. And JR said, you know, Nick's 29. It's going to be amazing how good he will be when he gets more experience. It's like, well, Nick Jackson's probably doesn't really need any more experience. You know, that was a JR contribution there. So So all you people who are miffed about my appraisal of JR's commentary will probably be even more miffed now.
Okay, so the main event is Chris Jericho versus Kenny Omega. Winner faces Hangman Page to become the first AEW World Champion. What did you make of the main event and the decision for Jericho to be the one to go over at the end?
Well, I mean, we were talking about this last week on the podcast, and we were like, well, maybe it's time for Jericho to go over. And to me, it made sense. Had Kenny Omega gone over, this whole damn show would have come across like a vanity project for the Elite. So I think it was important that Omega did not go over in this match. Also, I think Jericho's a guy that obviously he's still got a few years left in him. But I mean, it seemed to me to be a better move to have him in the championship match, because Kenny Omega's a guy that's going to be around for a long, long time to come. And as we saw with the IWGP heavyweight title, Kenny, Omega's win over Okada, when it finally happened, felt so big because it was at the end of a long story. And I think that was something that sort of held Jay White back. I mean, he's not as good as Kenny Omega. But when Jay White won the IWGP title, there was no real story behind it. And he was following Omega, who'd had this incredible story. So I think Omega in AEW is going to want to do something like that, where he's got a story, he's got a journey to the belt, so he's not just winning it on show number two. I think that's how he's going to try and approach this, so that when he finally does win that title, it'll be comparable to his IWGP heavyweight title win. Does that make sense to you, Kenny?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense.
I mean, I enjoyed the match. I thought it was well done. It was a really tough match. Omega bled from the nose, which again really added to the realism of this. There was some kind of nasty looking bumps at times with him falling through tables and things, but I think they were in control of most of it. Let's face it, these two guys know what they're doing by now. So, I mean, I enjoyed the main event. I mean, again, maybe just slightly too long. But I mean, I thought it was a very worthy show closer. And I'm not going to spoil what happened next, Kenny, until after you have said your piece about it.
Well, I didn't love this match as much as everybody else did.
Right.
It was good. Everything about it was very good. There was a lot of drama and high spots. It just didn't connect as well with me on the night. I enjoyed it much more watching it back on TV. I think maybe because we'd just been through the Cody and Dustin thing.
Yeah.
And that was just like everything in you kind of left you during that match. I think Jericho going over is the right decision. I think having him face Paige automatically kind of does more for Paige than if it was Omega against Paige. I thought it was probably the right. I don't think you could have closed with Cody and Dustin. I think that kind of had to be on, you know, 2/3 to the top of the card. I just don't think you would have closed with that one.
I don't know. I mean, I think it could have closed the show, but I think what they were doing here was sending the message that the final match regarding the title should go on last, because the theory in wrestling is your title match goes on last. I know sometimes that doesn't work out that well, and Jericho knows all about that with a match with Triple H at WrestleMania 18. But that is the theory, is that the title match, or a match that's got title implications, that goes on last. So I do get it. And I guess they feel like, well, we need to position these two people as our stars. But yeah, I mean, you look back and think, well, maybe Cody and Dustin should have closed the show, because that was the emotional peak. And I think the books and Pentagon and Phoenix and Jericho and Omega, to an extent, both kind of struggled to follow that, because people were so drained after the emotional impact or tsunami of that match. I think they turned it round in the post-match, Kenny.
And then after Jericho had won and cut this really good heel promo in the crowd, we got the debut through the crowd of John Moxley, formerly Dean Ambrose, takes out Jericho with a dirty deed as a referee. Then him and Omega start brawling everywhere. It ends up with him doing a dirty deed on top of the big chips, and then he throws him to a table. So a very, a big angle to finish the show with a new star, John Moxley, being there. Here's a question for you. Do you think that had Jericho just won, and that would have been the end of the pay-per-view?
Yeah.
Do you think the show would be like, how important was it at the end of the show that they had the Moxley thing and sort of set that up? How important was that to the success of the show, do you think?
I think it was very important. It was very important to AEW to have that sort of blockbuster finale. Also, it was really important to Kenny Omega, because after he lost to Chris Jericho, it's like, right, what's he going to do next? Obviously, we don't have any TV programs to set up the next pay-per-view or the next event. So it set up Omega's presumably going to be fighting Jon Moxley at the next event. So it set up Omega's next appearance, set up Jon Moxley's first match, got people talking at the end of the show. I mean, the only thing I would have liked maybe was maybe some hint on the pre-show that Jon Moxley was there for the people who were like, well, I watched this pre-show and, you know, it hasn't turned my world upside down, so I'm not going to buy the event. I think if there'd been some sort of hint or maybe some type of silhouette of him backstage or just a shot of him there, I think that would have been something that I would have argued for if I'd been on this creative team here. Get Moxley on your pre-show, because maybe that's going to tempt some of those WWE fans who aren't convinced to buy the show, rather than having the surprise at the end, because it still would have been huge. In fact, it could have even been bigger, because people are like, what is Jon Moxley coming out? I mean, it still would have been huge in running in at the end, but then maybe more people would have watched the show. So yeah, that's the only thing I would have changed about it. But I felt it was very important to the success of the show that he was there and he did what he did. And I thought it looked really strong. I thought the DDT on the chips looked great. And then he hit what kind of looked a little bit like a John Cena AA off the chips onto, I'm not sure what he landed on, but that looked terrific as well. So, and then the show went off the air and the cameras lingering on Jon Moxley standing tall. So yeah, I thought it was a tremendous way to end the pay-per-view.
Yeah, I also thought JR, that was, if Cody and Dustin was the best work that he did in the night, I think the second was the putting over of Moxley when he debuted, because he just put him across like as a major star. And I mean, we know he is anyway, but I was talking to some people over the weekend, and I said, you know, if you go to like a WWE show, right, like say there's like three things that you really want to happen. At the most, they'll give you two of the three.
Yeah.
And it felt like AEW specifically gave you all three, because they want to show you that, like, that's what they're going to... They're always going to give you a little bit extra than what you can get. And, I mean, in terms of our first show, I thought they did a pretty good job overall of everything. So it was a show that didn't really dip in quality, and it was... You know, it didn't feel like a four-hour show when we were live in the arena. You know, there was only, I think, nine matches, including the pre-show matches. There was only seven matches in the main card.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I felt like everyone got time, so... but before we do have something Jon Moxley really to talk about in a minute, but before we do, Finn, Raw and SmackDown this week.
Yes.
Fans are not happy. Fans are complaining on social media about the unoriginality of the presentation this week. We had Raw took over an hour of the show before there was any wrestling matches on it. What were your high and low points of Raw and SmackDown this week?
I mean, high point of Raw had to be Brock Lesnar's appearance with Paul Heyman. I mean, that was really funny. I mean, I thought it was hilarious as well.
I'm all here for Party Brock, by the way. Like, Party Brock is my favourite thing.
I mean, the thing that cracked me up the most is he comes out, you know, and he's got the Money in the Bank briefcase that looks like a 1980s boombox. You know, he's dancing around. It's reminding everyone of the work he did with Eddie Guerrero in 2004, just before he quit. And he looks like he's having a ball, wants to be there. I mean, let's face it, most people, when it comes to Lesnar, they're miffed because they don't really feel like he makes any effort. And okay, it's ludicrous and everything, but when the bell rings, you know all that's out the window. And he's still gonna be the beast. He's still gonna be a killer. And he did some silly stuff with Jinder, remember, just a few months ago.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, I mean, and he was a barrel of laughs there as well. I mean, what really cracked me up as well was later on he was out, and then Seth Rollins arrived to confront Brock Lesnar, called him a joke. And then Paul Heyman starts reading out the terms of the Money in the Bank contract. And Lesnar's like, he's surprised to learn that he has a full year to cash in the contract. And Lesnar said, I didn't know. And Heyman's like, how could you not know? And to me, that was just this great inside joke to really to the fans and to all of our expenses, really, is that Lesnar cares so little about all of this that he doesn't even, after all these years, doesn't even know the rules of Money in the Bank. You know, something that apparently he's desperate to win. So that just cracked me up as well. But I mean, you know, you look at the Lesnar thing and, you know, it's kind of like where we were last week. He's out there and then Kofi Kingston, who's still distributing pancakes, he's desperate to fight Brock Lesnar. Why? You're the champion. And Seth Rollins, he's like there, he's desperate to defend against Brock Lesnar as well. And it's like, hold on a minute. Rollins convincingly defeated Lesnar at WrestleMania. He's already proven that he can beat him. Why does he need to wrestle him again? So I don't like the way this is all, the psychology of this. To me, this is backwards, and it should be Lesnar who wants the rematch with Rollins, not vice versa. I know I said this last week, but this is the direction they're obviously going in. But I would say probably the Lesnar stuff was the highlight of the show, even though some of it doesn't make any sense. But you're right, a lot of it was tremendously unimaginative.
She's also very, very quickly give props to another great subtle moment where Paul Heyman was doing air guitar.
Air guitar, fantastic.
And then Lesnar was like stopping him. And then there's and even like Heyman, like such a pro, where like he like reacts as if he's like just got like a bit of whiplash or something just from being hit by Brock Lesnar. So
I mean, they're having a laugh, but I mean it's kind of at our expense. But I mean at this point you've got to find highlights. You know, if there's a highlight of Raw, you've just got to grab it. You've got to clutch it. You've got to embrace it. You've got to love it, Kenny.
See, the thing that I think they're going to have... So, look, I'm not saying that AEW are going to be a competitor to Raw or anything like that, right? I'm not saying that is what it is. That's a possibility down the line. But Brock Lesnar won Money in the Bank. Then he came out the next night and we were told that was the night he was going to say what belt he was going for.
Yeah.
Then you were left to be told the hooks next week when he's going to do it. And then he's all over the show, but he doesn't do any of it there. So you're kind of teaching people that like whatever you advertise doesn't really need to happen. And that's fine when you're the only game in town, but if there's another game in town who are delivering on everything and not having that many... Now, AEW will end up doing the same thing because every company is going to do that eventually. But at the moment, I just don't know if WWE should be, you know, putting out things like, oh, we're going to find out who Brock Lesnar's facing, and 2 weeks in a row, we get it baited and switched from us. Because then what starts to happen is you actually start to just not care who he's going to face.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's the best strategy.
Yeah, I mean the thing about Raw and SmackDown, I think some people were thinking, oh, after Double or Nothing, WWE's going to come out swinging. It's like Vince is totally no-selling this. You know, he's not... if you look at Raw and SmackDown... He's not worried. You know, that was very obvious from the content of Raw and SmackDown this week. It was business as usual, sadly. I mean, we had Dolph Ziggler attacking Kofi Kingston and we had like some blood there. So we had a little bit of realism and Ziggler's beating down Kofi. But I mean, who really cares about this match, Kenny? I know you don't.
No, not at all.
I mean, it just feels like a filler match. Feels like someone to give Kofi... Feels like something to give Kofi something to do. I mean... Who really believes that Dolph Ziggler is going to defeat Kofi Kingston for that title? I mean, I don't. Do you?
To me, it was just like Dolph Ziggler is a talented guy, but I feel like for the last 2 years or 3 years, because remember when they first did the brand split,
yeah.
Take Two, and he was the guy who Dean Ambrose defended the WWE title against at SummerSlam, and at that point it was like, what? Like Ziggler's going to be in that spot, and then. You know, but then he managed to even get that career versus title thing with The Miz, and that was really good.
That was really good, yeah, absolutely.
But since then, it's just like, he was the Nakamura feud that, you know, it didn't kill Nakamura, but it certainly, you know, wounded him. He won the US title, and then he dropped it, and then he turned up at the Rumble again a month later for no reason. The character doesn't change, but he shouts all the time about how he's the best that there is, and it just... He's not an interesting character, and he was on far too much of the TV this week.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, I hope they have better ideas come September, come October, November, because Dolph Ziggler cutting these promos is it's just a, you may as well just give them the channel that TNT Drama's on.
Yeah. I think he's really kind of a late fill-in. He's a stand-in for Kevin Owens, who's not going to be part of the Saudi show. So it's like, right, who have we got who's on, who we can just bring in and book against Kofi Kingston? But it's like, it's just problem with Dolph is he's just got no heat, and it doesn't feel like anything he does is going to generate any heat. I mean, that beat down on Kofi with him being stretched out and everything on the previous week's SmackDown, it's just didn't really feel like, you know, you look at the Cody and Dustin thing. Obviously, we had a lot of blood there. But I mean, we've genuinely got a lot of heat there. And there's just no heat at all on Dolph Ziggler. And he's supposed to be this guy who's really, I mean, he's coming in and he's trying his hardest. But I just feel like the character cannot be saved, I don't think, in WWE. He just needs to disappear for a while and maybe come back, or maybe not come back at all. But his time, to me, is up in WWE, and I hope this is his last feud. I didn't really like seeing Drew McIntyre out as Shane McMahon's Deacon Batista. You know, Drew is the insurance policy, and Shane's out there. It's all about Shane versus Roman Reigns, and we had a match between Shane and Lance. I'm not even going to try and pronounce that surname, because I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly. So it was just all about getting Shane over for this match with Roman Reigns. Is anyone really that bothered about the match between Shane and Roman Reigns? Kenny, do you know anyone who's excited about this?
No, I do not.
And, you know, Shane's out there and he's got a massive sweat on, and all he's done is cut a promo. So I think the guy probably needs to lose a bit of weight. I think he's carrying too much weight on that frame. That's my...
Shane now sweats without physical exertion. That's when you know you need to take a look at yourself.
Absolutely. And Roman Reigns comes out, and he just took Drew out with a single Superman punch on the stage. I mean, it was like Deacon Batista at ringside with Brother Devon. And like, Drew's just looking like a nobody. And Roman Reigns is, you know, super Roman. And it's just, you know, Roman Reigns is on Raw. They're not even really bothering to mention the wildcard thing anymore. It's like they don't feel like it's necessary. And you're like, well, why is Roman on Raw? Isn't he a SmackDown guy? It's like, oh, yeah, there's this wildcard rule, but already I don't care. And, you know, with Roman being on Raw and SmackDown, that reduces the amount of time for all the guys that are supposed to be the stars of the future to have matches and feuds and promos and what have you. I mean, you know, Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder, when was the last time we saw them? What's happened to the Viking Raiders?
They're Viking Raiders right now, or as Sond and I call them, the Viking War Raiders Experience.
I mean, it's just like, where are they? And it's, oh, we don't have time for them because we've got to put the SmackDown guys on this show because they're the only stars we've got. And we're going to put them now on both Raw and SmackDown because, well, we need big stars on both to stop ratings dropping any further. And, you know, in the process, it means we don't then have time for the people that are supposed to be the stars of the future. And speaking of which, Cesaro versus Ricochet was on Raw. Really good match. But it was just like, you know, why are they, Ricochet pins Cesaro, and they actually had like a really good match, but it's like, it doesn't really mean anything, does it?
No, the thing, I mean, I think we spoke about this off air before we even started. I think one of the problems right now is that, you know, people start talking about SummerSlam, you know, after WrestleMania. That's the next big WWE event that people are thinking about in their consciousness. And I've not heard one person over any platform or podcast that didn't talk about, you know, this match could be at SummerSlam or this match. So if nobody's talking about any matches for the second biggest show of the year, that to me is a bad sign that people aren't even fantasy booking what they want to see at SummerSlam because of that kind of disenfranchised. So, we brought up a thing. I mean, obviously, 1995 was worse in terms of what the talent was like and stuff. I mean, there was great talent, but there was also Mantor and Dumpster Josie, but at the same time, it was only a one-hour television show. It wasn't 5 hours.
Yeah.
You watched in 1995. Would you say that watching 2019 now and watching 1995 then, was 1995 worse with everything taken into account?
Well, I mean, I think it was, yeah. I mean, anyone who disagrees with me, go and watch In Your House 4 or In Your House 5 or In Your House 3 or King of the Ring 1995.
Worst event of all time.
Yeah, go and watch those shows. But the thing about the thing about that era was the company was losing money or just come off a period where it was losing a lot of money. And there was a lot of concern for the future. WCW had signed a lot of WWF's historical big stars. Hogan, Savage, others were going over. They were about to launch Nitro. You know, things were changing there. I mean, also WCW was hiring people like Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, some people who seemed very futuristic wrestlers at the time. And really seemed like they were trying some new concepts, whereas Vince was really still stuck in 1989 and pushing the same thing. Okay, yeah, he featured Bret Hart on top, and Shawn Michaels was obviously going to win the title at WrestleMania 12. But the real format of it, not much had really changed. He wasn't pushing the monsters anymore, but that's because he was drug testing, because he had to, so he didn't have, you know, the talent. That talent that he pushed between in the 80s couldn't perform for WWF anymore because of the way things were. But in terms of creatively, if you look at what they were doing with guys like King Mabel and Yokozuna and acts like that, not a whole lot had really changed that decade. So you were really looking at the product and thinking, right, where are the stars coming from that can change things? That was what you were looking at. It's like, who is there on the undercard who is there on the undercard who can move up the ranks and become a bigger star and give us fresh matches and really give us hope that things are going to change? And we, you know, the Diesel thing, he was still champion at that point. He would lose the belt to Bret at Survivor Series that year, wouldn't he, Kenny? That actually was a really good match.
Yeah, that was a great match.
Yeah, but Diesel as champion, he was not a success. Obviously, Razor Ramon at this point, he'd been established mid-level player and he'd really kind of done everything he could there. There wasn't really anyone coming through the ranks. I mean, Jeff Jarrett had that really good match with Shawn Michaels at In Your House 2, but then had quit the company right after because they were going to reveal that Jesse James, as he was at the time, Road Dogg, was the real singer of the song. So Jarrett had gone. And it just, you know, it just felt like the company was just standing still and not really pushing forward and didn't have the pieces there. The pieces of the jigsaw weren't there to complete the puzzle. You look at WWE now, they've got so much talent. You know, obviously it's very frustrating looking at WWE setup now because they've got all this talent that are hungry and want to perform. So many people in developmental who could be brought up and who could be stars. So they've got the people there to make this work, and the barrier is the guy at the very top, Vince McMahon, as I'm sure we'll discuss in a moment when we talk about the John Moxley interview on Chris Jericho's podcast. So, you have the people there, you have the staff, you have the talent, you have the setup to make this a success. Whereas in 1995, it all seemed rather hopeless. You're like, how the hell do we get there? Now, looking at what we've got, I'm convinced, Kenny, that 3 or 4 weeks of consistent, productive booking would change the mood entirely in WWE and people would view the company completely differently. I also want to mention as well is that WWE generally does put on at least a couple of good matches per week. There are things on the programming that, like, for instance, I thought Daniel Bryan did a really good promo on SmackDown. I enjoyed the Kofi Kingston versus Kevin Owens match. I thought that was well done. Ricochet versus Cesaro was well done. Okay, it didn't really take either of them anywhere. So, I mean, there are good matches each week. There are things on the show that are really good. You go back to 1995 and sometimes even finding one good match on a pay-per-view. You know, I mean, we're just talking about the Bret Hart versus Diesel match. Oh, wasn't that a really good match? Because you didn't really get really good matches that often from that company in 1995. I think also the things are different now because they're putting out so much product. There's so much televised product, whereas back then we had Raw and the other TV programs were mostly like squash matches or recap shows. So I think that's part of the reason people have got viewer fatigue is there's just so much product out there. And we're kind of spoilt for choice as well now when you think about it. There's so much stuff for us to watch. You know, you go back to, can you imagine it? WWF of 1995, Kenny, having to put on a 3-hour Raw and a 3-hour SmackDown each week. Can you imagine them doing that?
Can you imagine how much Nikolai Volkov that would have been?
You know, but I mean, we would have really had something to complain about. You know, they had enough trouble putting on a 3-hour pay-per-view. Never mind a 3-hour Raw and a 3-hour SmackDown each week.
What I will say is just from watching Raw and SmackDown this week, it just all feels quite lifeless right now. It doesn't feel like,
yeah,
like the idea that what you're building towards is Corbin and Seth Rollins. You know,
yeah.
Like it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of excitement coming up. So I don't know.
I mean, look at the main event this week: Sami Zayn versus Seth Rollins. I mean, Zayn lost to, I think it was Kofi Kingston on last week's SmackDown, and then he lost to Braun Strowman, was hammered by Braun Strowman on last week's Raw. Actually, Braun used a power slam move we were talking about earlier. So why the hell is Sami Zayn wrestling Seth Rollins in the main event of this week's Raw after he's just racked up 2 losses? Explain that to me.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's like you've massively devalued wins and losses to the point where it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter who wins and who loses, because you've just taught us that wins and losses are meaningless. And when, you know, that happens, then your star-making structure, you know, the whole machine basically fails, because you need the wins and losses to matter so you can build new stars. And, you know, the fact that Zayn was in the ring with Seth Rollins, they had a good little match. But everyone knew that Seth was going to win. You know, why was it happening? Where does it take them? It doesn't take them anywhere.
So, yeah, I mean, we'll cover WWE probably more next week. Next week it might be as well for us to hold off on recording the podcast till after Super Showdown. I don't know if that happens next Friday, so maybe that's an idea.
Yeah, definitely. We'll record on the Saturday, Kenny. No problem.
Yeah, that'll probably be good. And then we can discuss all that at the same time. So to finish it off, though, there was the Jon Moxley interview on Talk Is Jericho that got released earlier today. And it is already hitting the headlines everywhere. He talked very extensively about the WWE creative process. Talks about how he knew that he wanted to leave about July of 2018. Talked about certain, you know, procedures and stuff. And I guess there was something that was in there that I thought would not make you happy, Finn, but almost be something that you'd be happy to know, that he shared the disdain of the leukemia thing that he had to deliver last October.
Absolutely, he did. And what was even more striking to me was that he brought up there was something that Vince wanted him to say that was even worse. And he wouldn't say it on the air, would he?
He literally told Jericho, I'll tell you off air, but he said, if we had said that, he was like, somebody would have got fired.
And it probably would have been me. And he was saying, you know, the sponsors would have quit on us, and Susan G. Coleman would have, I probably pronounced that incorrectly, that would have been problems with that. And, you know, that is just so telling. I mean, what came through to me was that the problem is Vince. I mean, we've known this all along, and people, oh, it's the writers that are to blame. Oh, it's all these writers who don't have wrestling backgrounds. It's like, well, hold on a minute. You've got Michael Hayes there. You've got Bruce Pritchard there. You've got Triple H is involved in the process. You have wrestling people there, but Vince McMahon's a wrestling person, for Christ's sake. You know, at the very top of the food chain. But the problem, and this was something that Ambrose mentioned again and again, right, Kenny? The problem is Vince.
Yeah, he did. He was very clear. No. I wanted to make sure to listen to all of it before we recorded today, so we pushed it back a little bit. I think this is like the most important wrestling interview that everyone should listen to since the Punk and Cabana one in 2012.
Yeah. Because
I think what it does is it actually outlines examples and somebody from the inside who's telling us what was going on. Because nobody's been able to do that really, right? Since, you know, Punk was the last guy that really did that to an extensive degree, and I think whether you're a WWE fan or you're not, I think it's a must listen. I don't think you can really, you know, be fully formed in the world without listening to this. It's just it adds so much to stuff. I thought he came across very well in the interview. I found myself liking him a lot more at the end of it than I did at the beginning. You know, because at the beginning I liked him enough, but like by the end of it, I was kind of going, now I understand this guy. You know, I understand that like they've always kind of, you know, they made him do all the zany stuff and whatever. And he says at one point, he said, you know, I would try the best I could to get it over, but you know, sometimes there was just no hope, and that's what it was. But yeah, it's a very, and then what was it he called? He said that if you're an elf who thinks you can be a dentist, then go and be a dentist. he said he didn't even look at the offer that WWE gave him. It wasn't about the money, and yeah, obviously, like when they say it's not about the money, it's not these people are getting paid pittance, but you know, he's walking away from the known, right? Better the devil you know, is what they say. He's walked away from that to go into a new thing, and you know, because he talks about one of the things he talks about is when he was coming back, in 2018, he had kind of said, well, you know, wouldn't it be better if I turn up at SummerSlam? It's a surprise. It's a big moment, and da da da. But instead, like as he was kind of prepared for everything, they were like, "Oh, we want you back at TV on Monday," and then they just gave it away on the free TV show. But he had all these other ideas, and he talked about being really excited about when he was making his comeback, and he would think about ideas to, you know, reintroduce the Ambrose character and give it like a new coat of paint or whatever. And he said that every time he would get excited about an idea, he would go, "Oh no, they wouldn't use that. No, they wouldn't let me do that." And I mean, that's what you're. Now that he's going to get to go to AEW, and he also said that he spent $8,000 on the video.
Yeah.
And he filmed that on two of his 2 days off that he had in between wrestling loops. So before this and before everything else, I was, like I'm sure most other people were kind of maybe believing the whole, you know, Dean Ambrose on the Stone Cold podcast is the real guy. But when I listened to this, I got a sense of that something maybe disconnected there, but this is the real guy. This is the guy that, you know, loves wrestling, is so passionate about it, and feels kind of beaten down by a system that isn't designed to let you creatively grow and is deciding to go off and do his own thing. So, more power to him. I think I'm glad he got to say publicly that he didn't want to do the leukemia stuff, because I think that was something that we all were kind of just a bit bummed out about.
We absolutely were, and I felt for him, and he was explaining how it all works, in that you go in and you have that confrontation with the writer, and then you move up the food chain, and then you've got to have that confrontation with Vince, and you're like, oh no, and you've got to wait there for ages outside his office, and it's just the whole process is just killing your spirits, and you know that you can't win, and that, you know, he's really persuasive and really manipulative. And he'll sell it to you, and you know that this is this machine, and you can't really break it, and you've got to kowtow, you've got to conform, and you've just got to do that to be part of the show. I mean, it was very telling, wasn't it, when he was saying that, you know, he said that thing about Roman Reigns, and then there was something else that they wanted him to do, and he just drew the line, and Vince actually did at that point said, oh, you're not comfortable with that, well, yeah, okay, yeah, we won't do it. So that was actually quite telling there, where Moxley was saying, well, if you tell Vince straight that you're not doing it, then you won't have to do it. But it's more the sort of the constant pressure on you, and just how draining it all is, and how your will to resist is sort of broken. Your morale and your spirit are just crushed.
He talked about he felt sometimes like he was going into a depression.
Yeah,
he would tell Vince McMahon that he would get a feeling of sickness and just felt horrible every Monday.
Yeah, and he was just talking about it, wasn't he? Is that he was really looking forward to his comeback, and he's watching all this in 2018. He's watching all this wrestling. He mentions Impact, mentions Ring of Honor, all this stuff. And the more he's thinking about actually going back and being part of that system again, where he's not going to be able to change his character, and he's not going to be able to do something new and different that might get over. He's just going to be doing the same old thing. And it's just, it just drains you of your enthusiasm for the job, to the point where nothing you can do is ever, you know, maybe you'll have like a small victory here and there and something might get over, But as he said it, they saw him, or Vince saw him, as this zany guy, you know, that would turn up in like a milk float or whatever. You know, he said, oh, it's, yo, that's what you do. It's really good. This is what you do. You're a zany guy. You know,
he even said at one point, he said that when the Shield broke up, that he, you know, he felt that there was never a plan for him. And it was always going to be that Rollins would beat him, and then Rollins and Reigns would go on to be these big stars. But because Ambrose got over, and he said, you know, he was like, I got myself over. And, you know, he takes credit for that, says that that was something he did, and that they were kind of forced to do something with him. And, you know, is it true? Is it not? Who knows? But there's been a lot of cases where that's happened in the past. So if you judge it on history, the likelihood that there probably is some truth to it. Yeah. I mean, do you remember around the time when the Shield were breaking up? Do you think he's right? Did you think Vince just kind of thought he's the third wheel? We don't really care about him. Do you think that sounds about right?
Back in 2014, that would have been.
Yeah.
Seth Rollins did the big turn on him. Big turn. Yeah, it was just before Powerslam closed that, Kenny. I don't know, really. I mean, I thought Ambrose was... I mean, we knew that Rollins was the guy who was the best worker of the three. But we knew that Roman Reigns was the guy that they saw as the top star. So you never really know what's going to happen with Ambrose, because he was a different character. And it's, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult, really. I mean, because the Shield had been a big success as an act during their first run, which would have been from 2012, came in Survivor Series, didn't it? 2012.
Yeah, that's right.
Through to... Was it about May or June of 2014?
May of 20. It was right after they had the payback match, the second one.
That's right, yeah. So they had, what was that, like 6-17 months, something like that. So, I mean, they had a really good run. It would have been surprising if Ambrose hadn't been used as a star, because he was over. And I think what they'll do is they'll say, well, maybe we don't have plans for him, but let's just send him out there. And if he gets a response and people like him and it happens for a few weeks running, then we'll give him a shot. And because he was driven to get himself over, and obviously very driven to be a star, they would have seen that in him. And maybe Reigns and Seth Rollins might have said something as well, and maybe they would have put in a good word for him. So there's a lot of factors there that I think were probably going to preserve him and so he would have a second chance to become a star on his own. But I mean, who knows? You never really know what's going on in that company, and things just change so much. Things can change for no reason, as Ambrose spelled out very clearly in his interview with Jericho.
Yeah, he said that the creative process that Vince McMahon has in place is not good.
He called it crap, didn't he? He just said this crap that I'm giving week after week, and he was just, you could just see that he was just so resigned to failure there if he'd stayed, and that he'd reached the point of despair long ago, and that he knew it was never going to change. That was him. That was why he wanted out. And Jericho echoed those comments. He said, well, that's why I left as well. I just felt beaten down and just tired of the system, and tired of having to fight for everything. I mean, you know, I always said years ago, that the creative process, the booking team, is supposed to enhance the talent. If the creative process or the booking team is hindering the talent, then what's the point of the creative process?
Well, remember, it gets to the point sometimes where the people who are on TV less in the lead up to a pay-per-view mean more. Well, the people who are on... So, like, it's kind of went backwards.
Well, that's it.
And I had a conversation with Keith Elliott Greenberg about this when we were in Vegas. And I said, you know, the thing is, Vince McMahon's not an idiot by any stretch of the imagination. He's a smart guy. He wouldn't have got to where he is if he wasn't. But the thing that baffles me, and I don't know whether this is something to do with his age or whatever, but, like, you know, he knows 50-50 booking does not get you anywhere. He knows that that's not what his successes were. But yeah, there's all these things that he goes back to time and time and time again that have failed and failed and failed and failed and failed. And I just don't understand why he keeps going back to the same well all the time, when it's very clear that, you know, the first couple of times you go, okay, well, yeah, you know, maybe it was an anomaly that it didn't work that time. But we're now like 50, 60 times down the line, and yeah, we're still seeing it. And that's the biggest thing I don't understand, because he's smarter than that, and I just don't know why it's not coming through.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about the Ricochet and Cesaro thing, why isn't Ricochet, okay, he can lose one match to Cesaro, but he needs to win the bulk of them, and the final one needs to take place on a pay-per-view. And if he comes out of that the decisive winner and he gets over, and I think that guy can, because the match with Cesaro on Raw this week, people were really into it, he can then challenge, or potentially challenge, whoever's the US champion, maybe Samoa Joe. And he can then, oh, wow, this guy's got momentum. You know, this guy's a winner. He can now go into his title match and maybe he can win the title. And then as champion, he's upped his own prestige and he's upped the prestige of the title. And that's how you create stars. And you're right, Vince knows this better than you or I, Kenny. I mean, he could, if he was a guest on this podcast, he could tell us what was what. The real question is, why doesn't he do it?
That's the million-dollar question. That's the one thing I don't understand more than anything else, is that they've got themselves in this sort of like failing thing, you know? But I mean, let me ask you this to kind of round things off a little bit.
Okay.
Off the Mox interview. There's a lot of WWE fans that I've seen on social media and stuff who've been saying that they really kind of despair for WWE. They don't see it getting any better. What do you think WWE do, if anything, come November, if AEW are starting to do good ratings? Do they react? Do we see any form of change, like in 97? Or like, what do you think the future is going to be if AEW start to make some sort of real threat?
Well, I mean, AEW isn't going to be any sort of threat to WWE for quite some time. They're not going head-to-head. I mean, I saw your interview with Eric Bischoff, and Eric Bischoff very sagely pointed out that, no, AEW certainly shouldn't go head-to-head with a WWE broadcast. So at least he's learned something from that fiasco with it, TNA back in 2010. I mean, AEW's going to be on broadcast TV. I mean, I don't know what sort of numbers they're going to get. I have no idea. I mean, I think WWE's numbers will be a lot higher than AEW's. The thing with AEW is that maybe this can be something that grows into something much bigger and attracts a new audience, which it may well do. I mean, I'm sure that that's what they're hoping for. I'm sure some WWE fans will watch it. Some WWE fans won't watch it because they'll only watch WWE, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it's always been.
But do you know what? One of the things that that WWE try to do, and as an example, the 24/7 title is a good example, right? You see all these videos on Twitter and whatever, and that's the .com people and the social media people doing these sort of storylines. And lots of people engage with them. But the problem is when they then go to TV, Vince McMahon does not care about what you did there. It's not even going to come into his infrastructure. Whereas when you watch so far AEW, you know, being the elite, Road to Double Nothing, all the different like little brands on social media along with the TV, they're all singing from the same hymn sheet.
Sure.
And I feel like that's something that like, when it comes to social media, that's something that WWE should be thinking a bit more, is that, you know, if I watch a video on Twitter where Matt Hardy is, you know, becoming half woken and broken as he's trying to find R-Truth for the title, I go, I'm going to watch SmackDown tonight because Matt Hardy's woken again, and then there's no mention of it.
No mention. He was just one of the pack that ran past R-Truth while he was hiding in a photo booth on Raw. He was there with the B-team and all these other guys that don't matter.
So any of the good work that you do is then being kind of
flushed down the toilet.
Exactly. And I think that, look, we're not going to be the podcast that sits and says that AEW are the best thing going and sings from that hymn sheet or whatever. Cody said in the press scrum that we did, he said, you know, if you guys, to the media, he said, if you guys think that we did some stuff that was poor, then report it. That's your job. Like, we want to be held accountable for what we do. You know, and look, hopefully that continues for a long, long time, you know, but you need to hold companies accountable. And I think that if you're a WWE fan, you should want this to work, because if not, I mean, look at what WWE are putting out right now. It is grim, 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 grim.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is, as I said earlier, this is solvable. They've got the talent to do it. They've got the people to do it. They've got the money to do it. They've got everything. You know what I mean? Why isn't Shayna Baszler up on Raw, Kenny? I mean, look at Becky Lynch. I mean, what's she doing on Raw? It's just like she was in a tag team match this week with Nikki Cross versus the Iconics. Becky's still got support. When she tagged in, people were really into her. But that's going to fade if she's not put into a program with somebody that's seen as a worthy opponent. And like Shayna should be there. Should be there now, challenging her, beating her down, trying to get some real heat. Or someone like that, you know, because they don't have anyone on the main roster right now who's seen as a worthy challenger. I mean, look, Asuka and Kairi Sane have disappeared. You know, they could both be challengers to the to Bayley or to Becky Lynch. They've just vanished. You know, you asked me a question anyway, Kenny, about WWE. What's going to happen if AEW takes off later in the year? I mean, that's obviously unknowable. I mean, I think something, but I mean, I don't know what's going to happen because Vince is still very much in charge. We know this. We know this anyway. If you know, John Moxley interview with Chris Jericho just made that so clear that it's his way or the highway. And that is the way it is there. I think something might change later in the year if numbers continue to fall. I mean, I think Fox is expecting a lot more viewers than SmackDown's going to draw. And a lot of questions are going to be asked at that point because they're paying a lot of money for this show, as we all know. So I think when push comes to shove later in the year, when all these huge amounts of money are going into WWE coffers, and then the company's not delivering the numbers that the stations want, I think a lot of questions will be asked and I think something will happen. I'm not quite sure what, but I think something will change. I mean, I think Vince, I don't know whether he's ever going to step aside or whether the family can intervene and persuade him to step down. I'm not really sure how it's all going to play out because obviously he's still in charge. But I think something will happen when, if the TV stations aren't getting the numbers that they want, and given the way things are set up right now, I don't see how the hell they're going to get the numbers that they want. Because as you said, Kenny, this product just feels pretty flat. Just, there's no real drive. There's no real imagination. There's no real ambition. When you watch Raw or SmackDown, you don't think, oh, wow, they really set out this week to get that guy over or to get that storyline over or to really sell this event. I mean, okay, we've got The Undertaker appearing on Raw next week. But I mean, you know, this whole Undertaker Goldberg thing is just, what the hell have they done to promote that? We've had to sit through the Triple H versus Randy Orton highlights video God knows how many times. Those two are available. Why don't they do like an angle or some face-to-face instead of having a highlights video? Why not try and do something new? It all just feels sort of phoned in. Not all of it, because some of it, you know, as I mentioned, I thought Daniel Bryan did a good job on the promo this week. Some of the matches were pretty good. But there's just so much more they could be doing, and it wouldn't even be that difficult for them to do it. That's the frustrating part of it. But I think, to answer your original question, I think there will be change later in the year. I think something's going to change.
Okay, so Finn, I know you're going off on holiday soon, which means that if you're going on all these extravagant holidays, you need to somehow fund these things. So please give everyone your plugs where they can buy your ebooks, etc., to fund all your various excursions.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm heading down to Bath tomorrow for 4 nights. So yeah, looking forward to that. So. My website's finleymartin.co.uk. You can find the links to my books there if you choose to do so, if you are interested in purchasing them. Obviously, I would like you to do so, but that's up to you. Where can people find you, Kenny?
You can find me at KennyMC1985 or Inside_the Ropes. Also, patreon.com/InsideTheRopes is the place to go for bonus content. You can get this podcast 24 hours early. You also get an overrun. This week's overrun is going to be next week because it's going to be early next week. Anyway, it's a whole thing. But there's still going to be one for the 101 episode. Also, youtube.com/InsideTheRopes for interview content. We had interview content going up over the weekend with everybody from Eric Bischoff and Arn Anderson to Cody, Jericho, The Bucks, Dustin, Britt Baker. We're now up to over 80,000 subscribers up there, so please do go and check out the content there as well. So, Finn, I hope you enjoy your trip to Bath.
Oh, thank you very much, Kenny. And I think we're going to be recording on Tuesday. We're doing that bumper Power Slam overrun. And can I also just say as well, the week after that, so it'll be not next week, the week after, I'm going to be doing another written Q&A, and a lot of people sent questions in for our Power Slam 100 podcast, which we didn't get to answer on the podcast, and I'm going to answer them in writing.
There you go. There you go. So listen, enjoy your holiday.
Thanks, Finn, Kenny.
And we'll be back now. The main podcast is probably going to be next Saturday on Patreon, Sunday on the main feed, because we want to just include Super Showdown.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it dates in 24 hours. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.